Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Shartok. Joining us on this Medical Monday to discuss mental health and substance abuse issues is our friend, Dr. Jennifer Michaels, medical director of the Breen Center, Berkshire County's largest community mental health agency. Dr. Michaels is also assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts. She's board certified in both general and addiction psychiatry and has been in practice for over 15 years. Dr. Michaels, welcome back to Medical Monday.
Thank you very much, Alan. Good to see you.
The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. The phones are not yet ringing, which is very, very unusual because Dr. Michaels is a tremendous resource. So I'll ask you my questions. That's what I want to do.
Okay.
Let's begin with, I had a recent back operation, and one of the things that was prescribed was OxyContin. I haven't touched it, of course. We filled it, but there is some of the stuff that's floating around. I'm getting rid of course, if anybody's thinking about coming to get it at my house. And the question is, this is turning out to be one of our greatest addictive problems, isn't it?
It is. You're very right. I'm curious, how many pills of OxyContin did you get?
I never looked inside the thing, and I never counted, but it's a fairly, you know, there's little, then there's middle, then there's big. This was sort of middle.
It was middle. Yeah. Well, you're bringing up an issue related to what we call iatrogenic addiction.
Whoa.
Big word. It simply means it's an addiction caused by your doctor.
Oh.
Iatrogenic. You could have an iatrogenic infection caused by your medical care. This is iatrogenic addiction. And what we're seeing is doctors are over-prescribing opioids, and patients are ending up addicted. And then when their prescription runs out, they can't stop. And we've created a new problem.
Well, we also have some of this stuff floating around. I mean, that's one of the problems. It's just there.
Yes.
And when somebody is addicted to OxyContin, I know one such person, they start looking around for it, sending out emails. Does anybody have any of this stuff?
Yes.
I've seen that. And it's not good. But I don't want to blame my doctor. He was just trying to help me with this.
Yeah, I think doctors are trying to help patients with pain, but we do see patients who are desperate, you know, people who have addiction, going into friends' houses, to going into open houses and going into
the
cabinets and stealing medicines. Now, if you have leftover pills, you do, Alan, I recommend you call your local police station. They have drug roundups.
That's a great idea.
And you can get them disposed of at your local police station.
That's great. I'll do it today because I'll tell Roselle right now. Roselle, grab that stuff and bring it over there.
There are no OxyContins in the Shartok family house.
That's right.
Right? Okay.
That's what we're saying. That's
okay.
Right. Okay. So that's one thing. Okay. Well, I suppose I wanted to ask you something else, but let's go to the phones because after all, it is your program, folks. Let's go to Jim in Cooperstown. Okay, Jim in Cooperstown, you're on.
I'm calling regarding a disorder that I just found out about. It's called PANDA, P-A-N-D-A, and it usually is follows post-strep or post-scarlet fever. Do you know anything about that?
PANDA disorder. I don't know. It probably is an acronym for something.
I think it's called, here's the acronym, Pediatric Autoimmune Disorder. And it occurs after strep throat, which then develops into a scarlet fever, which then results in this PANDA disorder, which basically, the reason I'm calling it is my son just was diagnosed with it. And it started off with a fever from strep back in February.
Mm.
And subsequent to that, he started developing all kinds of other issues like tics and fatigue and mood disorder. And, you know, we thought it was depression, but once he got worked up, he found out that he developed this autoimmune disorder, which resulted in basically Hashimoto's thyroiditis. So he lost his thyroid, and he developed these tics. So, I mean, like, you know, he's under care now in the treatment, but I was just wondering if there was anything you knew about it.
Mostly
a pediatric issue.
Yes, it's more of a pediatric issue, and I certainly am not an expert in that area. But you're right in bringing up this issue that people will end up suffering a sequela or a consequence of an initial infection, and mm-hmm. it can manifest in strange ways. And sometimes it's psychiatric, sometimes it's more physical, and definitely strep throat rarely can manifest that way. So it's good that you have a diagnosis, and then you can follow up with the right providers.
Well, right. Yeah, I know. But, you know, that's something that, didn't even know about it. And if you Google it, you only find stuff from like 2008. So it's really a recently diagnosed disorder. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people, you know, had this disorder and they were diagnosed as having, you know, depression and other things. But it was a result of this. And apparently the treatment is, obviously for the thyroid, you have to take Synthroid. Mm-hmm. But for the other issue, you have to take long-term antibiotics.
Yes.
Or IVIG, which is infusion of immunoglobulin.
Hey, Jim, thank you for the call. Appreciate it very much. I'm sure you've helped somebody today.
Thanks a lot. Yep.
Yeah, bye-bye. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in now are excellent. And I mean excellent. John in Massachusetts. John, you're on.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call. As I was explaining to the receptionist, I have an adult son in his 40s, lives in an apartment that we own, goes to work and, you know, is productive in many ways, pleasant to be around, but he drinks way too much, and I say way too much, I mean a pint or more of vodka and beer chaser daily, as he's expressed it to us. He drinks to get drunk. He still manages to function at a very high level, but I realize the saying is that you can only change yourself. So I'm not looking for a magic bullet, but is there anything we can do?
Yes, there's plenty that you can do. And I just want to say, I'm so glad you're calling in. I'm sorry for your problem, but I'm so glad you're calling in because so many people are in your shoes. I mean, so many people I see struggle with loved ones who are drinking or drugging, and they don't know what to do. First of all, there's a free self-help group called Al-Anon for family members trying to help loved ones. So I recommend you look for Al-Anon in your neck of the woods.
All right.
Also, I would recommend that you call in the troops. And by that, I mean, is there a spouse? Is he married? Does he have a primary care doctor, a good friend who can help you to leverage your concern? So it's not just you against him.
Yes.
And you know, just the facts that it's unhealthy to drink excessively. You don't even have to use the A word, you know, alcoholic. It's unhealthy for your body, your brain to drink excessively. So those would be a few things to think about.
Yeah, we have talked with him about our literally concern for his well-being, his liver, and other things that are susceptible to damage from alcohol. He is seeing a social worker and having, you know, every other week meetings, but she doesn't seem, we have no idea what she says or, you know, because we don't discuss it with him by, you know, agreement. We don't know if he is telling her how much he drinks. So, I mean, is it completely unethical for us to in some way try to contact her? And
good question, John. So a lot of people think because of HIPAA, I can't talk to my loved one's doctor, I can't make the phone call. You certainly can call up a provider and say, I know you can't talk to me, but I need to speak to you. And then proceed to tell that provider your concerns. And you could call your son's primary care and say, look, this is what he's doing. I don't know what to do to help him. I'm worried he's going to drink and drive or ruin his liver.
Yes.
And you could tell his therapist that, too, because many times addiction leads to siloing. By siloing, I mean you know a bit of information, the PCP knows a little bit more, and no one's talking. So pick up the phone and by all means, make that call.
Hey, John,
I've
got to let you go. Thank you very much. So here's the deal. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. So Franny and John and Mark, stay right there.
Support comes from Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center's Graduate Social Work Program and Graduate and Undergraduate Nursing Programs, hosting an open house Saturday, October 5th, 11 a.m., St. Francis Hospital Medical Arts Pavilion, hudson-valley.adelphi.edu. Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York. Women-owned and operated with a combined 70 years experience. Eye exams by appointment, 518-459-2638. Premier Medical Group. Gastroenterology, urology, internal medicine, endocrinology, geriatrics, nephrology, and pulmonology with offices throughout the Hudson Valley. PremierMedicalHV.com. The Nature Conservancy's Adirondack Chapter, working to protect ecologically important lands and waters of the Adirondacks for nature and people. nature.org/Adirondacks. And Healthy Living Market and Cafe, working to support local agriculture with organic products, community outreach, and jobs. Open 7 days a week, 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. HealthyLivingMarket.com.
Okay, we are back. Let's go to Franny in South Glens Falls. Okay, Franny, you're on.
Yes, doctor. Everyone's got a friend or a family member or an acquaintance or whatever, but I'm dealing with a person who is a crack cocaine victim and wanting to find out the latest brain scan procedures that could allow one to trace and see where the drug has gone into the brain cells. I'm hearing words like MRI and SPECT test and whatever, and that once we know where certain drugs have lodged in the brain, we could treat them with medication or therapy. Is that, am I just getting...
Well, so it sounds like you're searching for a way to help, which is great. And I wish we had a simple answer like take a pill or perform the scan. We do know a fair amount, and I recommend that you go to a website, the National Institute of Drug Abuse, NIDA, and you will see scans and information about cocaine and its effects on the brain. Currently, we don't have a specific medication to treat cocaine addiction. There are talking therapies that can help a person who's addicted to cocaine. So we're not yet ready for prime time when it comes to diagnosing this disorder with an X-ray or a brain scan.
Well, I guess I don't want to be under a misnomer. I've read some research also that is telling me that a brain scan, can trace where the drug has gone into the cells of the brain. And in that way, we know what parts of the brain are being affected. Like the person that I have my connection and relationship with is very bad on cognitive skills, which was not the case before crack cocaine usage. And it's a young person. It's a thing that's happening in our society, and these drugs are all cut with poison now. There's not any good old-fashioned drugs around anymore. And so my information is getting to me that we can find out by brain scans where the
Franny, you made that point a couple of times. Let's just get a definitive reaction.
So all drugs of abuse activate a part of our brain. They're technical words, ventral, tegmental area, the nucleus accumbens. All drugs of abuse activate dopamine in those centers. And then damage will occur in that reward center so that things like food or sex or fun, you know, just having fun with friends no longer is rewarding because you've damaged your brain because of substances. And cocaine, in your friend's case, has damaged that part. And then chronic use is damaging to the brain too, but it doesn't direct the treatment because it's not unique for cocaine. So the best thing your friend can do is enter a drug treatment program, stop using cocaine so the brain can heal and learn recovery
skills.
Can
the brain heal?
Yes. So you know what's wonderful, Alan? When I was in school way back when, they said, you know, if you damaged your brain, that was it. It didn't grow. No cells grew. But we now know we have almost a miracle grow for the brain. It's brain-derived neurotrophic factor. It's like miracle grow for the brain that we actually produce. And brain cells can grow, they can build connections, and avoiding substances, alcohol, drugs will help the brain to grow, and living a healthy lifestyle, sleeping.
Well, Franny, you got your answer. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Okay, let's go to John in Springfield. Okay, John, you're on. John?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes, how are you today?
Good, go ahead.
I got a couple questions. First question would be, is marijuana addictive physically or is this psychologically?
Okay, well, you know, a lot of people ask this question, and many people feel that marijuana is perfectly safe and there's no risk of addiction. But about 9% of people who experiment with marijuana will end up addicted. So it's certainly less addictive than things like opioids or cocaine, but some people get addicted, and there is a withdrawal that some people will experience.
Okay. My next question, I'll make it real quick, is my addiction started with cigarettes, with tobacco, when I was a kid, and progressively moved into marijuana. The past few years, as Alan had back surgery, I had one myself and was prescribed some opiates. And I got hooked on those for a while. I got off of those and went back to marijuana. I guess my point is it's always been an addiction of some sort from one substance to another.
That's a great point. That I mentioned the part of the brain where addiction lives, and it's a very primitive part of our brain, and any substance will do. It could be food, it could be opiates, it could be marijuana, and the way our brain works, it will thrive with cross-addiction, going from one drug to a different substance. It could be gambling, food, but once we become addicted to one substance, we're vulnerable to all substances, and your case illustrates that. Yeah.
It's interesting.
How do I break that cycle, Doctor?
Well, you have a lot of options. You could go to a self-help group. These are free. They're ubiquitous. I mean, they're in every community. You could go to AA and or NA. You could see a counselor. At the Breen Center, we have a day program. Berkshire Medical Center has an inpatient program that's wonderful.
There's got to be stuff in Springfield.
Springfield, Albany. I mean, oh, I'm sorry, you're in Springfield. There are programs through Springfield Hospitals. So I would go online and look at SAMHSA, S-A-M-H-S-A.
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 Right.
SAMHSA, that's our government's program for referral to different programs. And remember, the motto should be one is too many, meaning one joint is too many, one cigarette's too many, one OxyContin is too many. Because sometimes people feel, I'm doing so well, I'm not smoking pot, I should be able to, you know, pop an OxyContin now and then. One is too many.
That's kind of like the Kenny Chesney song, one is too many, and one more is never enough.
Okay. There we go.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for calling. Okay, that leaves four free phones, 1-800-348-2551. Again, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Mark in Salem, New York. Okay, Mark, you're on.
Good afternoon, doctors. I'm 61 years old, and I have had, Alan can appreciate this, lower back problems since I was about 20. I had an accident at work, and I've been very active all my life. I've restored 18th century houses, done masonry, that kind of thing, and now I'm at a point where I have multiple discs that are either causing stenosis and sciatic pain down both legs, that kind of thing. And I had been seeing a rheumatologist in Schenectady who was a very fine doctor, but he retired. And on my last appointment, I asked him about something that my mother was taking for chest wall pain, and it's called tramadol. Tramadol. Is a doctor familiar with that drug at all? Or
yes, I am.
Okay.
I'm very familiar with it.
Now, when I asked him if he thought that would help my lower back, and he said yes, and he gave me a prescription for 6 pills a day, and then he retired. Well, my general practitioner wisely determined that that was way too much, and he put me down for 1 tablet of every 6 hours as needed. I generally take 3 tablets, 2 in sort of spread fairly close together in the morning, like when I first get up, and then maybe by 11 o'clock I have to take a second. And then by late afternoon, early evening, when I'm making dinner or something, I may have to take a third one because standing brings back some of those symptoms. But I am asymptomatic when I'm on it. My understanding was that now I see the law has changed, and if you're under 65, you have to get a script every time you get a refill, and if you're over 65, you can get refilled.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the sense of that is, but anyway, my understanding is that this drug was relatively harmless to your kidneys, stomach, liver, and not terribly addictive if it wasn't abused. Is that true? Because if I don't take it, the only thing that happens, of course, is after a day or so, the sciatic pain comes back, and you know, I gradually get to a point where I'm not functional, but it's not like it's a rebound so much as it is just that the pain, this covers up the pain.
Okay, Mark. So you mentioned a good word, functionality. You know, people take medication for pain, and our hope is they become more functional. And it sounds like you're taking your tramadol the right way. You're fully functional. Some people take medication like tramadol, and they become less functional, and their lives begin to revolve around tramadol or maybe an opiate. So tramadol is potentially addictive. Some people will take more and more over time. Some people take it just as prescribed, and they never have problems with it. So it sounds like you're doing well with it.
Yes, I am. But I was surprised to find out that it was addictive, because at the time that the rheumatologist prescribed it, maybe it was because it was a fairly new drug. They didn't mention anything about addiction. And
mm-hmm.
and actually my regular doctor, the general practitioner, didn't seem too concerned about becoming addicted because I was taking the smaller amount of 50 milligrams.
Yeah, tramadol is listed as less addictive and a non-opiate, but in
right.
reality it binds to our opiate receptors, so it has an opiate-like effect. And certainly I've treated people for tramadol addiction, but there are plenty of people out there who take it the way you take it and don't escalate use and are more functional.
Is that a synthetic morphine? Is that what it is?
It's a unique molecule. It's not a synthetic morphine, but it's a unique
molecule
that has some opioid effect.
Hey, Mark, going to let you go. Believe
it
or not, everybody's on the phone now.
Never
can figure that out. Thanks again.
Thank you,
Mark.
Yeah, bye.
Okay.
1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Carla in Saratoga. Hi, Carla.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So I have a question about a book called Gut and Psychology that I'm in the process of reading by the doctor's last name is McBride. I have a son who developed absence seizures at a young age. When we tried to put him on Xurontin for his seizures, he wound up developing severe depression and actually was speaking about suicide at a very young age. Didn't really understand the concept, but knew that he was really struggling. We've come to, over the last few years, he's 9 now, realize that he's kind of a chemically sensitive kid, but he does seem to have issues with depression, and there is some family background. I'm reading this book, and it talks about treating various mental illnesses with food. Touchy subject. I'm wondering if you are familiar with the GAPS protocol, G-A-P-S, and if you know folks have used it for their children or any adults, and if it's been successful at all.
I don't know specifically about the GAP diet. I can say that part of treatment can include a healthy way of eating or looking at nutritional intake. I would hesitate to recommend that diet would be the sole treatment for a mental illness. But by all means, every day I talk to my patients about what they're eating, how they're eating, what they're drinking, and I think it's an important part of recovery.
Is there anything we know, Jen, that leads us to believe that depression could come out of a specific food that we maybe should know about?
Well, you know, it's all interconnected. So yeah. I talk a lot about white foods, like the pastas, the starches, the potatoes, things like that, and increasing abdominal girth and increasing cholesterol and increasing blood sugar and how that is depressogenic.
Oh, yeah.
So it's all interconnected. You know, insulin levels will go up with certain foods.
Sure.
And also nutritional value of a rainbow of food. You know, you want a plate filled with colors and how that's the healthiest diet.
Carla?
Yes, this child is on a very colorful diet. We discovered early on that he has issues breaking down certain proteins, dairy. He's recently diagnosed as a celiac. And that's kind of what brought me to this particular book. So I was intrigued if you would have any insight. I haven't been able to find a lot of support, and I completely agree with you. Diet alone will never be the key here, but it's been a tremendous help, in fact.
Okay.
Carla, thank you for calling. There's so many people behind you. I really appreciate it. Yeah.
Thank
you. Take care. Have a good day. Bye.
Okay, we'll go to Linda in Kingston. Linda, you're on.
Hello. This is a mental health issue. I'm calling about my sister, mm-hmm. who is 70 years old and moved mm-hmm. here several years ago for retirement. And she started out with a part-time job and was doing very well and had 2 emergency hospitalizations. And she's now at a point where she stays at home. She's morbidly obese. She won't exercise. She spends her days watching TV, eating and smoking, has no friends. She is depressed. I spoke to her doctor about it, and she supposedly is on medication. And, you know, I always hear you can't help people who don't want to be helped, but I just can't see her falling apart like that. She has no life at all.
And your specific question to Dr. Michaels is, what should you do? Yeah.
You know, it sounds like an overwhelming problem. You love your sister. You want to help her. And on some level, you're powerless if she won't accept help.
Yes.
Again, I would call in the troops. You know, that primary care physician can send in an in-home assessment to evaluate your sister and make recommendations.
What is that, an in-home assessment?
Well, she's a senior, so yeah. Can have senior services that will come in, whether it's bringing food or assessing her cognitive functioning, making recommendations for support or a program. Mm-hmm.
Her cognitive functioning seems to be fine. She's running her life. She just doesn't have one.
All right. Her depression, they can evaluate that. But I would ask the primary care and make a lot of noise so that the primary care is more involved, so it's not just your problem or your sister's problem. And I don't know if there are other family members who could help you to convince her that she needs to do more.
Well, yes, there's a cousin. We've been working on it, but nothing seems to happen.
Okay. And you know, the other thing is people hear, oh, my sister's on an antidepressant. She's getting some kind of help. Sometimes antidepressants don't work.
Uh-huh.
And you need a different antidepressant or you need a talk therapy. There's a wonderful therapy called cognitive behavioral therapy
mm-hmm.
that's geared towards depression.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would also want her to have some kind of psychiatric evaluation to see if there's a way to get her going, get her engaged.
Okay. I understand what you're saying. I don't think she'll accept any of it, but it's still worth trying, I guess.
I'm not a professional, Linda, but I say one other thing, and that is you should take care of yourself because this can get depressing in it.
Yeah, you know, yeah, just it's being true. Able it's to do very that. Stressful.
I like Alan's intervention, too. Yeah.
Thank you, Linda. Appreciate
it.
Okay. We're going to take a short break, 7 seconds or so. We'll be right back. If you're Allison or Joseph or Betsy, hold on there. We're coming.
Support comes from Express Pediatrics Highland. Walk-in urgent care for children, specializing in trauma care, including fractures, rashes, wounds, asthma, tick bites, sports injuries, and more. ExpressPediatrics.com. Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center's Graduate Social Work Program and Graduate and Undergraduate Nursing Programs, hosting an open house Saturday, October 5th, 11 a.m. St. Francis Hospital Medical Arts Pavilion, hudson-valley.adelphi.edu. Dr. Richard Holub at the Neurological Associates of Albany, providing Alzheimer's research programs for over 25 years, currently enrolling a research study for people with mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. AlzheimersAlbany.com. Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, a community-owned natural grocery store dedicated to sustainable agriculture, the local economy, and the environment. Berkshire.coop. And Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York. Identity Eyewear, it's what sets you apart. EYEDENTITY Eyewear.net.
And here we are. Let's go to Allison in Goshen, Massachusetts. Allison, you're on.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm calling my specific broad question is major mental illness and smoking. It seems to me the mental health community is basically ignores this. They don't seem to do anything to try to help. Specifically, my concern is my 33-year-old son with schizophrenia, who's improved his life incredibly in the last 10 years, but he's still a very heavy smoker. And his father died just a year ago, a lifelong smoker, but not nearly as heavy as my son. He died of brain cancer, lung cancer, bladder cancer from smoking.
Mm. Well, very important question you bring up, and I struggle with this too because I treat all types of people with mental illness, and most of them smoke. People don't know this, but a majority of people with serious mental illness have co-occurring tobacco dependence.
Yeah.
And for the longest time, the philosophy was it's a human rights issue. If they want to smoke, let them smoke. Here they were going to their doctor's office, and we weren't dealing with it. I'm hoping the tide has shifted, and I know I can say for my office, every time I see a patient who has tobacco dependence, I offer them treatment. I encourage them. And we now have these great modalities, replacement therapy, a patch, gum, a lozenge. We even have these little devices, cigarettes, fake cigarettes. And what we find is that if we keep talking to them about it and offering that people can make changes. And we have a harm reduction model, meaning that if you want to stay on nicotine gum for 10 years, that's much safer than smoking those 10 years. And that could be a very successful treatment.
And what is it, Jennifer, what is it that creates this need? It's almost if you light up a cigarette, you're in control of something. Is that, you think?
Well, does it seem to fulfill some either deals with the side effects of the heavy-duty medication, or it sort of supplements what the medications don't provide?
Well, there are many factors, and just what you both said, and we also know that smoking cigarettes releases dopamine. It's a feel-good neurotransmitter. It's where our addiction center lives. So if I am addicted to smoking, I miss a couple of cigarettes. I feel anxious. I feel depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And when
but
I
you don't, because you don't smoke.
Well, there was a time I smoked, so I can relate to it. It's very hard to stop, and people are very fearful of stopping. So a lot of encouragement, and even this is an idea. Even a little intervention counts, like saying to someone, "I know you're not ready to stop, but what if you just stop smoking in your car, and let's do that for a month and see how it works." Or, "I know you don't want to stop, but what if you wait 1/2 hour from the time you wake up until you have the first cigarette?" Things like that move the addiction towards recovery. So that's something to think about.
Hey, Allison, that was a great question you just asked. Thank you so much.
Yeah, a big problem, and we have to tackle it. Thank you.
Thanks, Allison.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Joseph in Albany. Joseph, you're on.
Hi, I have a question. My primary care physician prescribed 5 milligrams of Valium for me to take for fibromyalgia. I was wondering how long I can take that for, if it's addictive, if it's going to wear off the effects eventually.
So Valium is potentially addictive. Addictive is a strange word because you will perhaps get physiologically dependent, meaning that if you suddenly stop it, you'll have withdrawal symptoms. Does that mean you're addicted? Not really. Addicted is that you want to take more and more. You're taking it to get high. So you may end up getting physiologically dependent, but not addicted.
Now, I remember when Valium was the drug of choice. You couldn't turn around. A whole Woody Allen film was based around it. Is that true? I don't hear as much about Valium as I used to.
It's fallen out of favor. People are more likely to get prescribed Ativan or Klonopin, sometimes Xanax. They last a shorter period of time. They don't build up in the body as much. So it's an older generation benzodiazepine.
Huh, interesting.
Will I become intolerant to it eventually?
Are you taking it for anxiety or
fibromyalgia?
So is it to alleviate pain?
Yes.
Some people will become tolerant to the effects and some not. So I really can't predict for you how it will go, but there is a risk that you may need more over time. And for some people, they take one and that's all they need.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Joseph.
Sure. Okay. Best of luck.
Yeah. Let's go to Susan from North Adams. Okay, Susan, you're on.
Okay, Dr. Michaels. I was wondering if you could give the public an overview of Dr. Walter Friedman and his method of doing lobectomies in the 1950s.
I don't know Dr. Friedman's work, so I'm sorry that I won't be able to do that. So.
I can tell you I picked up a CD. It was on PBS. You can get it at the library. You can also go on, the Internet.
Okay, but Susan, because we've got a lot of people behind you and almost no time left, what basically was his philosophy?
Okay, he did not want to spend the money to do lobectomies in the underneath, the operating room and paying for those expenses. So what he did was he perfected a method. It was he used an ice pick. He went underneath the nose and the eyeball. He took a hammer and went into the cranium, and then he took it and swung it back and forth.
Sounds
this
awful.
Is the truth. I know. That's what I wanted to put through to these people, what they did to people without consent.
It's horrific.
Without consent. And, the thing is that they, in the media, they always portray, people with mental illnesses doing horrible things, but they don't realize that in the 1950s, he would line up about 70 patients that were psychotic, and he would do them all within.
Susan, we're running out of time. But what's the name of the book?
Okay, it's called. It's not a book. It's a CD from PBS.
Okay.
Okay. It's called Dr. Friedman.
Right.
And a matter of fact, I think it's narrated by some of his sons.
Okay.
They called him the Angel of Mercy.
Yeah. Well, sounds awful. Sounds awful.
And then I made a mistake. I picked it up and I saw a man, a doctor pointing at an X-ray, and I put the CD in, and I was horrified because they actually showed the footage. I mean, real footage.
Hey Susan, I wish we had more time to talk to you, but you brought up a very horrific idea, and we'll all sort of follow up on it. Thank you very much.
And Alan, one thing I want to say is Susan brought up a good point that, many times mentally ill people are portrayed as violent or aggressive, but more commonly, they are the victims of crime. They are victimized. So it's a misperception that they're violent and unsafe. And this is a good example, one of many.
Thank you, Susan. Let's go to Katie in Glenville. Katie, you're on.
Hi. I just want to ask a question about addiction. And young people, when they become addicted to a drug, when they have an underlying, either they're bipolar or schizophrenic, do they self-treat themselves? And a lot of times they're undiagnosed and they concentrate more on their addiction problem than the underlying, maybe, mental illness.
So the question then becomes, which comes first?
Right.
The treatment, the self-treatment.
Or does addiction cause schizophrenia or people to hear things, because I did know someone that started hearing things, thinking things, but I think it started when he was young, and it was never addressed, and he eventually did end up, you know, dying by himself, by his own hand, but...
Okay, Katie.
And I still believe that it was caused, maybe... by a mental illness that was never addressed.
Okay, Katie, let's get an answer.
Thanks.
Dr. Michaels.
It's a very murky matter because addiction and other mental illnesses go hand in hand. So, for example, most people who suffer with bipolar disorder have a co-occurring substance use disorder.
Sure.
And, you know, you could say that they're self-medicating, but they're also plain old addicted to a substance. You know, they have another illness, another brain illness.
Okay.
And sometimes... the first symptoms of a mental illness will manifest as misusing substances. And there's a vulnerability to a mental illness that is magnified by substance use. So they really go hand in hand. And you need to treat both at the same time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. And thank Katie. And thank you, Dr. Michaels. Let's go to Nancy in Poughkeepsie. Nancy.
Yes, hi. I just have a quick question. My son, who was around 20, he had to have a bit of extensive jaw surgery done. And there's so many of his friends that ended up becoming addicted to this awful Oxycontin. And so when the surgeon was describing to us, I went with him for this pre-surgery meeting, and he told us what kind of painkillers my son would have to be on after surgery. And, of course, Oxycontin was part of it. And I expressed to him, much to my son's dismay, is there any other non-addictive, less addictive painkiller? Even though my son stayed clear of all this addiction, he clearly has something of an addictive personality. But the doctor just poo-pooed my concerns, said I'll only give him like a 10-day prescription. And then it was off the table. The discussion was off the table. I'm just wondering, can doctors prescribe something else when you're coming out of surgery other than these addictive painkillers? Why are they so quick when in a young man to offer this kind of addictive painkiller?
Certainly. And you should know that if it's a smaller surgery, opioids should be off the table anyway. If it's dental surgery, Tylenol and a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory will do the trick. If a person does have a higher level of pain, sometimes an opioid may be indicated, but 3, maybe 4 days is all that's needed. And I always say you need an exit strategy. If you're going to get on those medicines, how are you going to get off? And Tylenol and non-steroidals work remarkably well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great you brought it up, and I think that doctors need a better education about alternatives to opioids.
You've got to undo the damage that some of them do, don't you, Jen?
Yeah, mm-hmm. We do. We see it all the time. Mm-hmm. Good intentions, bad consequences.
So the next time this does come up, can I be a little more strong in my presentation to the doctor of my concerns, because there are options out there?
Yes, and again, it's you have to look at the surgery. For example, when Alan had back surgery, that's big, serious, painful surgery. He probably would need an opiate for a brief period of time. It wouldn't be appropriate to say, take some Tylenol. But again, someone else could hold his medication, someone else could monitor, and someone else could say, well, most people need this for 5 days and then can switch over to a non-steroidal.
Yeah.
That's a good way to deal with that situation.
Yeah, and there are those of us who really wouldn't touch the stuff.
we
would writhe in agony before we do it. Hey, Nancy, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Susie in Massachusetts. Okay, Susie, you're on.
Yes, doctor. I'd like to know, what can we do as a society to take the stigma off mental illness? I've known several young people who have either had bipolar or paranoid schizophrenia and have turned to drugs and things, and one I know overdosed and succumbed to that, and she did not want to be that way. She did not want to turn to drugs, and she fought it, and people thought that she was just a low-life druggie, but she was not. She was a fine young woman, and it just happened.
Now, Susie, you have, of course, asked the question that all of us who had anything to do with the mental health community, in my case, my doctoral dissertation, have been exploring for forever. Dr. Michaels?
Well, I think being able to come here today and talk about it is one small step. I mean, I really am grateful to Alan for letting me speak about mental illness. And I think that as a society, we have a lot of growing to do. I remember when maybe 20 or 30 years ago, breast cancer was a secret.
Sure, CA, the parents were there.
You didn't say cancer, there were no pink ribbons. And I worked in a breast clinic and women came in with the most advanced stages. They presented because they were so ashamed.
Yeah.
In much the same way, people with mental illness and addiction are now showing up with very severe cases because of the stigma.
Mm.
So I don't have a clear answer. I think the more people talk about it and recognize it's a brain disease. It's not a bad person. It's a bad disease.
Exactly.
And there are a few people, I remember reading Catherine Zeta-Jones said, I have bipolar disorder, I'm checking in. The more we have people who are well known and just talking about the fact that they have illness, I think the better it is for this disease.
Well, and I hope many people who are listening to this will subscribe to that as well.
Yes.
Susie, thanks for the call. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Betsy in Woodstock. Betsy, you're on.
Hi. I just have a little story to tell. About 7 years ago, I was scheduled to have a bunionectomy. And the week before the surgery, the doctor gave me a prescription for painkillers so that I'd have it when I got home from the surgery. So I took the prescription and I looked at it and I said, how many pills is this for? And he said, 60. And I said, well, and it was Vicodin, which I think is in that category of drugs, isn't it?
It's actually the number one abused prescription med in this country.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
So I said, I don't think I'm going to need that many. Can you give me a prescription just for five?
Good for you. That's great.
And you know what? He wouldn't. He made out a prescription for 20. I only took two. And the reason I even needed one of them was because he had wrapped the bandage too tight on my foot after the surgery. And I didn't know that I could loosen it myself. I was a little scared to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it really hurt. But just loosening it did the trick. But anyway, when I went and picked up the prescription at a local drugstore, which I can tell you the name of it, but I don't know if you want me to.
Not necessary.
Right? And I got home, and I just thought, you know, I'm going to count these pills. I opened up the bottle, and there was two short. There were only 18 in the bottle.
So your example illustrates all of the problems that we're dealing with. From the doctor overprescribing to not listening to the patient to the pharmacy and potently diversion. You know, we have a big problem. And the doctors who are prescribing these excessive doses are really responsible.
Do you have any sense of what these things sell for on the market?
Oh, lots. I mean, so an 80 milligram pill of OxyContin sells for $80.
No, one pill?
We calculated this. You could pay your mortgage and live on the rest with a monthly, a good monthly prescription of OxyContin. You don't have to work.
Whoa. Betsy.
People who get these prescriptions on a regular basis, or anybody who is going to get a pain medication that's in that category, should right there at the counter before they pay.
Yes.
They should open up the bottle, pour them out, and count them.
Okay, hey Betsy, we're out of time. Thank you so much, and let's go to Bruce in Kingston. Bruce, you got half a minute to say your thing. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is had to do with smoking. Kind of comment question. Years ago, I tried to learn to smoke, and it didn't take. But I noticed when I came out intermission from theater or whatever, it gave me something to do with my hands and my mouth. And I wouldn't necessarily call that that part of an addiction, but it's a dependency, but it's connected to an addiction.
Hey, Bruce, I wish I had more time for you, but I don't. Thank you for saying that. Appreciate it. Okay, Dr. Michaels, any reaction to that?
No, it's true, and you want to substitute another behavior other than smoking.
Sure.
Don't live in a void.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we are out of time. My apologies to those people who might have been calling in but didn't. I want to thank Dr. Jennifer Michaels of the Breen Center for being with us today. We always love it when she's here. Support for Medical Monday comes from the Bassett Healthcare Network, bringing heart care to the people of Herkimer, Cobleskill, Cooperstown, Oneonta, and surrounding areas, Bassett.org. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Take a bow, Zach. Thanks to Colleen O'Connell for answering the phones. Tom Jove is our web assistant. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Shartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at wamc.org/VoxPop. On tomorrow's program, an open forum. Stay tuned now for a news update. But before we go, I want to remind you of all of something. And that is the only way this radio station keeps going. If you enjoyed what you heard today, if you found one thing that helped you with a problem or somebody else's problem, just try to remember that this is a unique service. And anything you can do to help out, anything at all, you know, whether it's $5 or $1,000, it helps us keep going. And there's the lockbox. Just go to WAMC.org. That's all. WAMC.org. You'll see the lockbox. If you go down the page, just contribute, and we really will love you for it. Thank you so much.